Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Inside is Capital. According to Neuberger Berman's Solving for 2026 Outlook, we're entering a market shaped by diverging monetary and fiscal approaches, AI-driven macro and micro disruption, stabilizing long-term rates, creative destruction in equities, and seismic shifts across private markets, which raises the real question for asset allocators. If AI is accelerating productivity while labor softens, if fiscal bias towards spending persists while central banks hesitate, if long-term premia have already repriced, and if liquidity in private markets is being re-engineered, then how are portfolios, both retail and institutional, actually evolving? To unpack that, I'm joined by Clay Kahn, head of Neuberger Berman Canada, as we move beyond the strawman view of North American markets and into a broader global multi-asset allocation conversation grounded in Neuberger Berman's five investment themes for 2026.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Clay, welcome. It is terrific to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I think it would be really helpful if you told us a little bit about yourself and about Neuberger Berman.
Yeah, so I'm Canadian born and raised. I've been in the investment management business for 20 years now. I started out on the institutional side in what I would describe as a seminal year in 2006. And then I worked at JP Morgan for 6 years. And then I started at Neuberger as the first employee here. And we really built a nice Canadian business where we manage about 30 billion Canadian, serving Canadians nationally. So we have a client in every province other than PEI. The book of business is mostly skewed toward institutional by dollars, but we have about 20% of those assets and what I would describe as taxable, high net worth family office type investors. And then the complexion of that business is about 60% private markets and 40% public markets.
How have the first 6 weeks of this year felt to you and your team at Neuberger Berman? What's your take?
As far as the portfolio shift, you know, on the retail side, you talked about public equity exposure. Canadian portfolios are still overweight Canada, even though it's been a great time to be investing in Canada and we love Canada. But just a simple diversification argument of owning 3% in, you know, having an outsized allocation to a market that's 3% of the overall public equity markets as measured by equity, it's hard to make that argument. And then the S&P's done really well. So what we're advocating is essentially, you talked about our solving for 2026, which is our themes for 2026, is this concept of a broadening out in equity markets, and that's really playing out. In 2025, the S&P delivered an excellent return of 18%, EFI 32%, so nearly double that, but EM 34%. So by far a standout performer. And that trend's really continued into the first 6 weeks. So there's more of a rotation into non-US assets, and we all read the headlines and we know why. And then the other is that you're seeing more of a rotation from value to growth, where the S&P is flattish. It might be, you know, year-to-date down after the news that's come out over the past couple, the macro news has come out over the past couple of days, but value is up meaningfully and growth is down. So that spread is real. And part of that is driven by just this broadening out thing that we're talking about. We're still constructive on the global economy, and value names tend to be more sensitive, or they might have a higher correlation to global GDP. They're more cyclically driven. So those value names have outperformed, and you see that as evidenced by EFI outperforming. You see EM outperforming relative to the S&P 500. So for advisor portfolios, they might look at their portfolio and say, wow, I'm dramatically underweight international, ex-US. How do I go about that? Just talking about my my personal background and how it sort of led me to where the business is today, with our focus initially being on the institutional investor and then essentially, you know, being in Canada for now 14 years. The first 10 years was really focused on the institutional investor and how we can partner better with them. And then it's pretty clear that, you know, the institutional investor, their mission is to pay the pension liability, and their portfolio is essentially set up to make sure that they can generate the adequate return and income to pay off that liability. But if you take a look at the retail investor is essentially using their capital to pay for their retirement. So the pension capital, the pension they're participating in, and the money that they're contributing toward the pension and the way it's being invested is used to pay for one form of retirement, pension income, while their own money is being used to pay for their retirement. But you see meaningfully different portfolios, right? And the question is why? For the most part, most of the capital that's being put in advisors' hands or retail investors are using is to pay for retirement. So I think that's a key point. And why are portfolios so dissimilar on the institutional side versus the retail side is sort of the key question in my mind. You think about thematically what the big trend is in Canada. I'm happy to unpack, like, I think the history in institutional investing in Canada is actually quite interesting. And I think it's salient to our conversation today. And it addresses a number of your points.
A lot of the examples that are being used in retail to describe how investors should actually be thinking about their long-term portfolios. One of the foremost examples has always been the comparison to CPP and, yes, and how CPP is allocated across all global regions, all asset types, the way in which, you know, sort of a pedigreed, you know, long-term well-managed pension plan is being managed is more what your portfolio as a retail investor should look like, as opposed to chasing returns or chasing yields.
Yeah.
Clay, what changes are you actually seeing in how Canadian investors are allocating capital right now? Are we seeing a shift more in that direction, or are they still, you know, sort of clinging to, you know, more basic allocations in their portfolios?
Yeah. So, just starting with the institutional side, because I think it does inform our thoughts on the retail side. On the institutional side, the big migration of capital has been going from public assets to private assets, where you see, you know, the Maple 8 essentially migrating a significant percentage of their overall asset allocation to private asset classes. And the reason for it is quite simple. It's essentially to capture the liquidity premium. And that's available across equities, fixed income, real assets, where if you have public equities versus private equity, you'll see a significant outperformance of private equity versus public equity. And the same is true for private credit versus public credit, and it sort of thematically carries on. So if you have a very long-term liability and you're investing large dollars, it makes sense. Every basis point matters. So if you're talking about a triple digit, sort of 100 basis point plus premium across those categories, why not capture it? There's a basic diversification argument. But the reason why, when I was talking about my introduction, you know, starting in the business in 2006, I mentioned 2006 in particular. Yes, there was a bull market and it was an interesting time. But the real change in Canada was in 2005 when the regulators effectively repealed foreign content limits. So in 2005, it was 30%. And then about 10 years before that, it was 20%. And then about 10 years before that, it was 10%. So the big shift was essentially going global in portfolios starting in 2005, right? And with 30% of the assets are non-Canadian, and then the remaining, so equities and fixed, were mostly Canadian. So the obvious thing to do was essentially to say, okay, Canada represents 3 to 5% at the time of public equity markets, GDP, as a fiduciary that wants to pay a liability, what should we do? And the short answer was go global. So what you saw was a significant shift from Canadian heavy portfolios to going global. Point two is, I alluded to this before, but going from public assets to private assets, right? And a lot of that has to do with volatility. But essentially, if you're an actuary and you're sitting there and designing a portfolio, something that offers diversification and a volatility smooth portfolio definitely looks better on an optimization exercise. So when you're adding assets, whether it be private equity, public, you know, private credit or real estate versus the public market comparables, you will see lower volatility and higher returns. So what that effectively means is more efficient portfolios when you add incremental private exposure. There's a lot to unpack, but the four major private categories are real estate, infrastructure, private equity, and private credit. And Canadian pensions have really been world leaders on investing in those four categories and invest directly or partnering with managers like Neuberger on getting exposure to those categories. And I'm happy to explore all four of those, but I would say the major change over the past 10 years is the increase in private credit exposure in these larger portfolios, these Maple A portfolios, and really at the expense of public market equivalents. And the one specifically is, and this is in apples and oranges, but is hedge funds, which you might find head scratching because hedge funds are more of an absolute return catch-all term for unconstrained investment strategies on the public side. But what the hedge funds try to do is generate, you know, cash plus 3 to 5%. So call cash, you know, long-term 3%. So 6 to 8% net returns with low correlation to the markets and low volatility. And hedge funds have had a tough run. Like we look at the HFRI index, which is like a basket of hedge funds, and they meaningfully underperformed a number of asset classes. They really haven't gone out and done that 8% that most people are looking for. And the fees are very high. So if you look at a similar asset class that's generated low volatility returns, 8+% or better returns with some income, which is also an important feature, it's really private credit. So private credit, and it's not like a like-for-like discussion. I'm sure people are not sitting around a board saying reduce hedge funds and add private credit, but that's essentially, you know, if you're an actuary and you're doing the mathematical modeling, the private credit solution makes sense. So that has been a sea change in markets. And we've seen some adoption just going back to the retail side and private credit, but it's still early days. There's been some interesting hiccups here, but you know, on the private credit side, there's been some early adoption, some local players that have had mixed results. And what we're seeing is now an evolution to larger names where a safer pair of hands, a bigger reputation, more skilled players that can deliver institutional type solutions to the retail investor.
The way that things shifted for the lending market in the last 10 years, you know, and following the financial crisis, of course, banking became much more difficult for mid-sized companies, right? For the large, you know, large cap and mega cap players, funding their projects hasn't been very hard for them. But for smaller and medium-sized companies, both in the US and Canada, by whatever measurement, it's been harder. And so private credit has really been a great opportunity for those companies to raise capital. And that often is happening at higher yields. So, you know, for institutions, it's very attractive, not to mention the fact that a lot of that private credit is floating rate. As interest rates climbed in the last 5 years and sort of have leveled off again, the yields on those private credit investments have gone up as well. And they're not subject to the whims of the duration risk of investing in longer term bonds, for example. So that's interesting. I think one of the really sort of big eye openers, speaking of private markets, is that most investors today are starting to realize that around 90% of companies, for example, in the US that have revenues over $100 million are still private. Public companies are going private. There's a shrinking number of publicly traded companies. And companies that are private, that are maturing or that are well along the way on their J curve, are choosing to stay private longer. So you have a shrinking public market, and then you have this expanding domestic US and global private market that's evolving in a way investors are just starting to cotton on to. Retail investors, institutional, of course, have been in that space for quite some time. I think on the hedge fund side, it's been very hard. I think at the retail level, it's been very hard to talk investors out of the equity market and into hedge fund strategies. For advisors, there's that line item risk that happens every year or every couple of years where, you know, you've moved your client into a hedge fund because you thought equities were getting, you know, priced for perfection 5 years ago. And then a year later or two, you're sitting across from your client. Your client's saying, "Well, that was a good move." Maybe the more important way to attack this question is how you implement those alternatives, those hedge funds, into your core portfolio. There's always that hesitation. I think it's not that it's not a good idea to be in absolute return strategies or into private markets. It's just that there's competing pressures that are arising because the rest of the portfolio is running while the absolute return side of the portfolio or the private market side of the portfolio is doing what it does, but it's not as good as. And so people tend to look at things on a relative basis. So I think that's why it's been hard for retail investors, for retail advisors to make bigger moves that would help their clients' portfolios to look more like longer term pension style investing, where you actually have true portfolio resilience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one issue that hedge funds have to begin with is that it's not, it doesn't mean the same thing to all people. There's a broad range of hedge fund strategies, the core of which is equity long short. And equity long short strategies, what they try to do is essentially provide equity-like returns, but with fixed income-like volatility. And what they find is that they just haven't generated those kind of returns, and they've meaningfully underperformed equity markets with higher fees. So it's hard to make the argument that equity long short as a category by and large is something that should take share from, you know, and generate that kind of absolute return that clients are looking for. So that category has generally shrunk. There's some excellent options out there, and there are some managers that have done terrific jobs. And as a category, it's just something that has not necessarily delivered, but there are some managers out there that have really done great jobs for their clients. So that's one thing.
I think the key, Clay, is to identify, you know, what role each asset that you add to your portfolio will have, and to understand why you did it. And so that, you know, like, it's not always just about returns. It's about building resilience into a portfolio. And I think there's a dichotomy where you have investors who are building wealth, who consciously, their conscious agenda is to build wealth, to, you know, build it as much wealth as they can while they're building. And then there's the other investor who is the established wealthy investor who has a higher priority on preserving wealth while still making returns, but not chasing 20 plus, you know, 15, 20% plus years. If they happen, wonderful, but you know, they're quite happy if they're making their absolute return of somewhere between 6 and 10%, as long as their portfolio is providing a real return, you know, real inflation adjusted return. That wealthy investor or well-heeled investor is looking to maintain their generational wealth, while those who are building their wealth are more interested in taking, you know, more risk than they realize.
Yeah, absolutely. And that again comes down to the liability and like the investment objectives. And you're very right that someone that has generational wealth that might not have any sort of upcoming bills that need to get paid for, you know, those assets.
Yeah.
Have an overwhelming number of assets relative to the liabilities. Yes, they have definitely different portfolios. What we see from a lot of family office investors is that they have portfolios that are more akin to pension plans. And you might ask why. And the key point is that they think of themselves as 30-year plus investors as well, and investing into generational wealth, where the high net worth investor might have that home they need to buy, the kid that needs to go to school, but with the goal of investing for retirement. So I think the family offices are actually a great place to start, because they're staffed with sophisticated investment teams, often with people that worked at pensions. But the key difference is the tax part. So, you know, there's been a number of studies done on like, what would Yale do if Yale were taxable? And I raise Yale because Yale is considered the pioneer of endowment investing or institutional investing. And for those of you who don't know, Yale basically has a portfolio that's 85% risk assets, 15% fixed income. And they spend a ton of time on selecting the greatest partners in private equity, you know, venture capital, real estate, to generate excess returns, and also just to capture the illiquidity premium. But as a taxable investor, how does that calculus change? And I think if you just focus on the public equity allocation, it's pretty meaningful. So, you know, we've done a number of analysis on like just how active portfolios have done if you look at taxes all in or returns all in. So, and your listeners know this, but I think this is an interesting illustration. If you just take a traditional mutual fund and you reduce the management fee, the investment alpha, you can assume some outperformance, but that's been challenging. And then you load on taxes. What we find is, and this is just like median information, that the average equity allocation in hedge funds after taxes has underperformed by 100 plus basis points. So I think the real rethink is, how do we incorporate the tax picture to generate the best after-tax return? So what we're seeing is the emergence of tax loss harvesting strategies, which effectively are a way to systematically harvest losses to reduce your capital gains tax bill, which then helps produce what we call tax alpha. So this is a broadly used strategy in the US, taking share from both ETFs and mutual funds. But in Canada, it's still early days, and it's something that we're seeing broad adoption in. And one specific case study, and I talk about family offices. They had a more traditional public equity portfolio that was style-based. They had, you know, value, growth, large, small, EFI, US, et cetera. Like just very much style box focused, geographically focused. And they underwent a pretty thorough study of how taxes impacted, fees impacted till after tax returns. And they found that their overall mix was underperforming if you just loaded on taxes. So what they decided to do is implement a custom direct indexing, or what we would call systematic loss harvesting strategy, to do that. And that makes a ton of sense because, listen, investment alpha is ephemeral. Some of your guests have done excellent jobs in doing that. Neuberger has some great PMs that have done that, but it is challenging. And what we're seeing is that Canadian family office is adopting this kind of technology to generate returns. And the returns are basically by saving on the tax bill. But if you look at the private equity side, and this is sort of going back to how Yale is thinking about returns. Like if you're Yale, you're not paying taxes on your endowment returns. But if you're a family office, you have endowment style money, but you have taxable gains that you need to pay. So if you're in a private equity fund that is investing and is doing its job, it's going to create capital gains. So what does that mean for you as a high net worth investor? Like that's something that you have to reduce from your overall compounded return. But if you have public equity exposure and that's generating losses, perhaps the two together are generating a better after-tax outcome. So we're seeing a lot of tax analysis being done, which is mundane, but actually adds a ton of value. So that's one thing that we're seeing. I recall China had become uninvestable. Europe was uninvestable. It came at a time, it's almost like, you know, the death of equities in 1981, right? Where there's this capitulation of sentiment. European stocks aren't doing well. Canadian stocks have underperformed US stocks for so long. And you know, the difficulty of making contrarian bets, right? When I look at private markets, for example, I think, you know, this is really, you know, there's such a chance, there's such an incredible opportunity in the private market space for, you know, long-term asymmetric returns, because they're not being valued by the market. They're not being day-to-day valued by the stock market. They're not going through, you know, investor sentiment, you know, pendulums. They are, you know, more than anything, you know, these are businesses that are being often in the private equity space that are being acquired or assumed and value is being added, you know, in a way that resembles sort of an alchemy where, you know, so much value can be added to a company's existing business model. And that by the time, you know, they reach a stronger point on the J curve, what you do end up with as a result of being patient capital, and say that in quotes, you know, is actually not only having a much often, you know, stronger return picture, but also more tax efficient, to your point about all the drive for tax efficiency. I think also, you know, like, so tax alpha is one of those ways, you know, we often talk about tax alpha. We talk about rebalancing alpha, a rebalancing premium from, you know, keeping portfolios in check. You know, the tendency obviously for investors is to, you know, let their high performers run. Yes.
Right. But what happens is they often wait until there's a turn in the market to make a decision about exiting. By virtue of rebalancing, you automatically get the rebalancing premium by rebalancing from the high performers to the lower performers in the portfolio.
I always go back to the institutional side because, you know, they're staffed with some of the country's best experts and they take a very long view on things. pensions, essentially, what they've done for years is invest globally, and they have a dispassionate view toward that. They more have a programmatic view of like capturing equity premium and essentially following the market and at the margin, overweight or underweight regions that they like or don't like. But what they don't do is they don't have wild swings in their portfolio by region or, you know, getting out of the second largest economy in the world, China. What you find is that it's more evolutionary versus revolutionary, making a basic diversification argument that, you know, over the long term, that you can capture different risk premia and you'll benefit from diversification by investing globally. And then you, in that, you get different companies, different sectors, different styles, different currencies and all that. It's really a basic diversification argument. And I think the tension here is momentum investing versus value investing relative to the US market, which is a growth index. Should I be investing in the growth index that's done really well, or should I be making a contrarian bet versus value? And our view is that you should have a mix of both styles to outperform. It's not that we think one is better than the other. We just think that both are complementary. It's just hard to do that. Yeah, it's just hard to do that when you're looking at your account every day and you see the rocket ship returns of the Mag 7 relative to the other markets. But that's reverse course this year and last year. So it's hard to advocate that you should be overweight or underweight at any given point in time. And that's our job and that's what we do. But it's pretty clear argument to make that investors should be investing globally. On private versus public, being a public company is very challenging. Like you're essentially held to a 90-day mentality. And a lot of businesses don't really generate long-term shareholder value in 90-day periods. They essentially need to reposition their businesses, maybe close certain divisions, hire new management teams, recapitalize the business, upgrade software. And what that often means is some pain before gain. And the public markets, when you see significant changes in the business and there's you know, some earnings disappointments, that can lead to significant re-rating of the stock. Where in private markets, because you have the benefit of time horizon and you're essentially valued based off of comps and operating metrics, mark to model again, you have the benefit of time horizon. But what the results show is that the private markets have generated significant outperformance relative to the public markets. There's a wide return dispersion. So your dance partner really matters here. It really matters in active equities as well, but the performance dispersion is tighter than it is in private markets, where you have pretty significant bands between first and fourth quartile performance. So I think that's part of the challenge too, is not which market should I be investing in? Should I be investing with private equity, but with who? So that's
right.
Layer of the calculus as well.
So how speaking of private and that being, you know, one of the trends that are shaping capital markets right now, what kind of solutions? The problem in the retail and high net worth space with private assets in general is the liquidity expectations mismatch. What are you doing at Neuberger Berman to address sort of the hybrid where you can create evergreen or interval funds?
I think the headline statement is that private assets are illiquid, full stop. Well, I think that the advisors are right in saying, like, how much of my client portfolio should I put in this? What most managers do in this case is they have a few different levers. The first of which is they have a liquidity sleeve that's generally about 10 to 15% that's invested in high-grade fixed income, and that's very liquid. And that's something that could be bought and sold in minutes. Most of these portfolios have a liquidity sleeve. The second is that you can match incoming investors with outgoing investors. Like, you match buyers and sellers. That makes sense. But on the 85%, which is the part that you want to talk about, what we generally do is focus on shorter duration investments. And you can accomplish that a few different ways. And thematically, it's actually quite interesting right now. You talked about how there's a traffic jam in private equity and there's not a lot of distributions coming out, and it's been disappointing. Just to put a finer point on that, we, you know, manage $150 billion private equity business. We're allocating $3 to $4 billion in funds a year. We're doing about double that at co-investments and secondaries. So we see a lot. And the age of private equity assets are getting older in funds. And there's two metrics that I think your viewers might find interesting. As of year end, based on our data, there's about 17,000 companies in private equity portfolios that are over 4 years old. And private equity, essentially what they do is they buy businesses, and in years 2 through 5, they execute on a value creation plan. And that's where most of the value creation comes from. So there's 17,000 companies that are over 4 years old. 5 years ago, that number was 10,000. That's a meaningful change. So what we find is that asset values haven't come down. Distributions have gone down. So investors are overweight private equity in the institutional space. So an interesting way to play that is essentially through the secondary market. And the secondary market, for those of you who don't know, is essentially buying the liquid assets from owners that have owned it for quite some time. And there's two forms of doing that. One is an investor invested in a fund. They want liquidity, so they can sell their commitment to that fund, the underlying assets and the unfunded obligation, to another buyer. And that's called the LP-led market. And on the GP-led side, that's where a GP has owned an asset for quite some period of time. They like the asset. The fund might be near the end of its fund life. And they effectuate what they call a continuation vehicle transaction, where a secondary fund comes in and buys that asset, creates a new fund around it, and the GP can continue to own that asset for longer. In both cases, the underlying investor, the LP, gets liquidity. In the first case, they effectuate the sale. So that's called the LP-led transaction when they sell a fund. In the second case, the GP-led, they have the option, not the obligation, to take liquidity or to roll into the new vehicle. The GP-led market was about 10 to 20% of exits last year, and it's here to stay. And a lot of people think about the IPO market as a key exit for private equity. It's in fact mostly sponsor to sponsor. So one private equity fund selling to another private equity fund. That's the maturation of the business. That's where it stands today. But the secondary market is burgeoning. It's doubled over the past 5 years in terms of volume. And the GP-led market is about the same in size as the LP market. So there's an interesting opportunity for what we view as the next, you know, several years in the secondary space, where you can acquire assets. And the benefit of acquiring an asset when a sponsor's owned it for years is that they have a pretty clear idea on how to create value. So those kinds of deals going into evergreen funds make sense because they have shorter duration.
Thanks for elaborating on that. I think it provides great insight.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I just think of it like Canadians love real estate. So I'll just give a rental home example. Let's say I was an entrepreneur that was in the business of buying homes and renting them, but I needed to raise capital. That's very possible when I buy a house that I like. I don't know where the leaks are. I don't know where the plumbing problems are. I don't know where the electrical problems are. I don't know all the sort of details of the house. But if I came back to you and I said, hey, look, I've owned this house for 4 years. I understand all these issues that I described before. I just need a little bit more capital to make a kitchen renovation. And I think after I do that, I can create more value. I think you'd have a lot more confidence that you're like, hey, look, you know, you know, in the second scenario, you know that house better than in the first scenario, right? Private equity is a very innovative space. For as boring as we are personally, I think professionally, we can be pretty exciting people. I think there's all sorts of ways to play this current environment, and that might be one of them.
It's interesting how, you know, what's happening institutionally differs so greatly from what's happening at the retail level, right? I mean, the view on risk is completely different. The view on risk budgeting is completely different. The view on allocations and, you know, term, how long are you going to be invested for is completely different. That's probably the biggest issue, you know, in terms of getting you know, everyday investors, retail, high net worth investors, looking at ways to create more wealth, you know, to add more resilience and wealth preservation in their diversification and within their portfolios. Are you seeing any meaningful shifts at the retail level where, you know, it stands out? You can actually identify that investors are taking a different view. Like, I know, you know, we've seen a shift in sentiment towards Canada as a, you know, because of last year was a big sort of tipping point. And we've seen a shift towards international, ex-US, international emerging markets, EFI. What other areas are you seeing identifiable shifts where investors are maybe tipping in favor of alternatives? You know, we've got all these income options in Canada, covered calls and other, you know, enhanced yielding products that are very popular. Are there any areas that you're looking at that sort of pique your interest?
Yeah. So, you touched on the public equity portion, which is real on the sort of non, let's say ex-US side.
international and EM. In fixed income, those themes that I talked about on the institutional side of sort of broadening mandates and moving away from domestic IG to broader mandates that can capture, you know, corporate credit risk premia across the spectrum of IG, high yield, AMD, CLOs. That's where we've seen significant growth. And that's not just us at this across the industry, where if you're an advisor and you're looking to build a diversified portfolio, something in between fixed income, like IG and traditional Canadian IG and equities, that does make a great intermediate step where you can earn nice yields and additional diversification. So that makes a ton of sense. It's still early days on the private debt and private equity sides, but there's lots of discussion there. But if you look at one of the many benefits of being Canadian is that you can predict the financial future by just looking down south. And you look at, on the equity side, I talked about, tax loss harvesting and systematic loss harvesting. That is very present in high net worth portfolios, where the preponderance of new capital going into our RIAs and when they're giving advice to clients is essentially you should look at this as a way to offset your capital gains bills. It doesn't make sense for investors that aren't paying capital gains bills. So for a Canadian that basically is just saving their RRSP, this doesn't make a ton of sense. But for someone that has a robust portfolio that's generating gains, this makes a lot of sense. And then, if you look at, Morgan Stanley or other larger platforms and the adoption that you're seeing in private market alternatives, it is pretty pronounced. And our view is that you'll see that here. And we're not the only GP that has this view. There's lots of excitement around Canadian investors and, adding evergreen private market alternatives. Because if you look at what a lot of Canadian investors do, is that there is this need for, and in some ways they're starved for diversification options, where the two risks that they have in their portfolio are equities beta and rates, high grade fixed income. And what they do to create diversification is they invest in what I would describe as more speculative things. And I'm not an expert on these areas, but like crypto or marijuana or other things, which tend to carry a lot of risk. There could be rewards, but they tend to be quite risky. But what I think that's the market's way of saying, I'm looking for diversification. I'm looking for other options. And I think, something managed by Neuberger or another great world-class firm in the private market domain makes a lot of sense for portfolios like that. Just done in the appropriate sizing with the appropriate education, it does make a lot of sense.
The fixed income sleeve in Canada is really I'd say it's under a lot of pressure in terms of where can I shift assets from in order to replace that ballast? That's the whole diversification conversation, of course.
Yeah.
If equities are the anchor of the portfolio, whether that's private or public, it's all equity risk. Most investors in a 60-40 portfolio have 90% equity or economic risk in their portfolio. But the fixed income portion is no longer pulling its weight, and you can't go out on the curve too far because interest rates are volatile. So you'd be subject to duration risk that you might not want, unless you do want. And of course, that's a different story. But the average investor, is looking for diversification against their equities, but now maybe they have to consider diversification against fixed income. Right. And so we've covered a lot of the alternatives and opportunities in private credit that can help solve that problem.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it seems to me that the fixed income sleeve is the bigger problem of the two sleeves, looking at the equity sleeve versus the fixed income sleeve, or what's traditionally the role of the fixed income sleeve. That's the bigger nut to crack for investors is what do I do to offset all my equity risk? Do I take on more equity risk?
Yeah. And you're right. In some of these strategies, if you go too far out on the risk spectrum, what you call fixed income is essentially closeted equity with capped upside. So I think that's something that advisors need to be, and all allocators need to be careful of. And it calls into question first, I think the core of the question is a 60-40 portfolio. How can it be improved? I don't think it's dead. I think that's hyperbole. But I always look back to the Canadian pension model and how they're investing. And I think it's a question of capturing three different different risk premia, and diversification is always something that works, and being programmatic in your investing. And like the areas that they're active in, public equities, they're global. EMDM, fixed income, they have a mix of public market and private market assets in there. And even on the private market side, when people say private debt, they typically are referring to direct lending, which is essentially sponsor-backed lending, which is what you described. You basically take in a lot of share from banks post-GFC to private capital, so groups like Neuberger. But there's also the emergence of asset-based finance, which is essentially, think of things that are non-corporate, so auto loans, consumer loans, other sort of non-corporate, non-real estate type debt areas. And then there's also higher risk strategies that we would describe as like capital solution strategies. So think of, being junior capital into large scale businesses. These are things that the larger investors are doing and they're adopting. They're just sizing it appropriately, but there's a diversification argument. And then on the private asset side, there's lots going on in real estate, the expanded definition of infrastructure. You know, not just toll roads and airports, but, solar assets, social assets, digital assets, private equity. Are you doing buyout? Are you doing venture? So I think there's a lot that we could learn from the Canadian pensions. I'm not suggesting they often have hundreds of people scouring the earth looking for the best assets for their portfolios. But I think that there's just some things that we can introduce just for diversification's sake, so that we're just not so reliant on the Mag 7, or we're not so reliant on the Canadian 10-year is doing to pay for our retirements.
When you look at portfolio construction conversations happening today, what feels different to you compared to a few years ago?
That's a very good question. I think, a few years ago, like one thing that stands out to me is the change in private credit. Like 10 years ago, we were explaining what private credit is in institutional portfolios. There were not discrete allocations. There were fixed income private equity allocations. Fixed income allocations tend to be benchmarked against some high grade index. And then for private equity, most people want to double their money and want like 20% returns, which is not easy to do, and not a lot of GPs have done that, but that's what they want. So going to them and saying this will do 10 net return and then, 1-4 MOIC, this is not, a great option for private equity. So there was lots of discussion on where it fits within the portfolio, what it is, and how persistent the opportunity is. Fast forward to today, it's, the full-on creation of private credit allocations within these larger portfolios and how to play it. Do I go mid-market? Do I go large cap? You talked about displacing the banks following 2022 and the volatility that we saw in the markets that year. And there was some acute issues created by some large syndications of like Twitter, the Twitter purchase. Private capital really stepped in and partnered with private equity to buy some larger companies, Neuberger included. And it basically showed that private capital is a direct competitor to broadly syndicated loans. Just the sophistication and the knowledge and awareness around private debt was a meaningful change in investor discussions. And then also an acknowledgement that, like I talked about real estate before, but real estate used to be like just the things, assets I talked about, office and malls. And then people said, okay, there's core assets, core plus assets, value add, opportunistic. The evolution of that in private credit is what I was mentioning before, which is the core part is direct lending and the capital solutions, or special situations type strategies around the edges, and how to combine all those to generate the desired outcome is a big change. A big change also is evergreen investing in private debt and then private capital specifically. Traditionally, what you had to do to invest in private capital was to invest in successor funds. So we would have a fund one, 2 years later, after deploying fund one, maybe 70% of it, we come back and say, please invest in fund two. And 2 years after that, please invest in fund three. And all of a sudden, if you have 10 managers that you work with, then that's quite a bit of complexity. So we've had some clients come to us and say, can you just set up a vehicle where we essentially have an ongoing commitment with you? And you essentially keep our capital at work and reinvest the principal to generate a higher, to build multiple. And That's been an innovation that you've seen in private credit, but that really echoes what people were doing in real estate, where in real estate for years, people were like, I want to own this building forever. And I want you as an investor to decide when you want liquidity and I'll value it for you quarterly. So private credit's adopted to do the same thing. And then private equity, you see these evergreen structures as well. But how do we deliver in a way where we can deliver liquidity, but give you long-term exposure to this asset class?
As we move toward 2026, what do you think will define the next phase for Canadian allocators?
That's a very good question. And there's a lot that could be addressed here. But I think it's essentially, how do we migrate the Canadian retirement portfolios to match the Canadian pension portfolios, while understanding that there's tax objectives or tax minimization objectives that they need to factor in. So how do we tie all that together? And I think that's a pretty exciting frontier. You know, whoever said that tax tail shouldn't wave the investment dog, probably at the time tax rates weren't as high as they are now. So definitely integrating tax into long-term portfolios for taxable investors is something that we think is a meaningful next frontier in Canadian retail, as we see from our U.S. cousins down south. And the second is, how do we introduce different risk premiums to client portfolios so that we can generate the returns they need for their retirement?
Yeah. It's such an interesting question. I mean, we've had a decade and a half of markets going up, and, you know, look, just on that basis alone, there must be a huge buildup of unrealized gains across the multitude of portfolios out there.
Yeah. I'll make a general statement, then I'll make just sort of a Neuberger statement. One is, and I'm not going to get the exact quote right, but the great and late Charlie Munger said the great thing about getting rich is you only have to get rich once. So going from, and oftentimes getting wealthy means being concentrated. That often is the path for people. Some people do in other ways. But preservation is really diversification. And working with a client on that journey, essentially going from a concentrated portfolio to a diversifying portfolio, is real. And then also, listen, our firm was, part of Lehman for years, and we had a lot of clients and a lot of employees that had a significant amount of Lehman stock. And those, that was a great investment until it wasn't. And at Neuberger, we had the real practical experience of seeing what happens when concentration can go wrong. So we always advocate to clients that you might love something, it might be your greatest performer, but idiosyncratic risk is real. And, the journey from concentration to diversification is something definitely worth honoring. And that's something that we would welcome to discuss with advisors.
I absolutely love that, Clay. I think, when you think about where wealth is created in the first place for most, families, it's in a business, right? It's in a company. It's in an entrepreneurial mindset. But what's ironic about that is that, while you're running a business and you mentioned idiosyncratic risk, you're taking so much idiosyncratic risk over the life of a business and running a company. And then because you're taking so much idiosyncratic risk, like you don't realize, like, you've gotten used to the hot water, right? You've gotten used to the temperature of the water of taking all that individual corporate risk at your own company. And then to have to shift your mindset to the idea that, okay, now you've done this great job of building wealth and you've got all these retained earnings and you've got all this, exited wealth that you've taken out of your company for your family. Now, how do you put it all together and keep it? Because when your time is up, your family is going to be the ones to have to pick up the pieces of, what do I do with this huge tax bill over here? What do I do with this huge tax bill over there? And if you can solve that problem beforehand, right? If you can solve that problem for yourself beforehand, but also solve that problem for your clients beforehand, that seems to be the real opportunity to establish your value as an advisor today.
Yeah. It reminds me of watching Who Wants to Be a Millionaire back in the day, and you see someone that's hit a level where they have guaranteed money and you see them go for it. And then you're almost like shouting at the screen, take the money. And sometimes it works out, but oftentimes it doesn't. And like it's tough when you've like you because I understand ownership of the business. I was like a first employee here, and I like have personal pride in the business. I'm sure lots of your listeners do, but I just think that like the investment calculation, it's pretty clear that some people would really benefit from the diversification.
Absolutely, and it seems to me that the biggest crapshoot of all is the estate. What happens on legacy? And with so many, probably like the bulk of assets held by investors is held by those who are over 55.
Yeah, exactly. We have some ideas around that, but yeah.
I'm sure, yeah. So, Clay, you know what, Clay? It's been such a pleasure talking to you. This has been such a great conversation. We covered a lot of ground, so much to think about. The most valuable part of it, I think the overarching part of it is obviously the wealth preservation angle, not only the growth, but the preservation of wealth, the tax efficiency. But more importantly, why? What's in it for your clients? What's in it for yourself to ensure that you've covered all those bases? Because that is to go your whole life, build up wealth, and not look after some of the, more nuanced parts of it that are actually critical seems to be, the biggest risk that many investors are unwittingly taking.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was a very succinct way of what I rambled on for quite some time. And you were very generous with your team. And I appreciate you having me on the show, and a pleasure speaking with you as well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Clay. I'd love to have you back anytime as well.